My guest today is the historical revisionist, Mr. David Stein, also known as David Cole. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Ryan. Thank you for having me.
At first, I want to thank you for having the courage to tackle such an issue and deal with everything you've had to deal with. I know from my end of it, and I tackle political topics across the spectrum and historical topics, and I get flack for a lot of them, but I have never had more backlash on any topic more than talking about the Great War, World War II, which is ironic because we seem to have the freedom to talk about every single other war, but when it comes to that one, there's a lot of backlash, and I can't imagine how hard it's been for you because you've been a trailblazer in that subject a lot more than I have.
In my situation back in the late 80s, early 90s, because I didn't have to, fortunately, I didn't have to deal with what someone like Ernst Zundel or Robert Farazin or David Irving were dealing with as far as actually being prosecuted in their country. I had to deal with mainly the private harassment, violence, threats of violence, hate mail, hate phone calls, and getting beat up on three non-consecutive occasions, and then finally the death threat that kind of got me to leave. But I'm not sure which one is worse, because I had the option of giving up and giving in, whereas a guy like Germar Rudolf was literally chased out of his country. I mean, he was told he was about to be imprisoned for doing nothing more than writing the same things I was writing. I mean, that he was not doing anything different than I was doing at the time, but I was able to do it legally and he wasn't. And that I've always had a tremendous amount of sympathy for him. I met Germar when he was very young, 1994, and he really felt optimistic that the strength of his reasoning powers could overcome the government's desire to punish him. But he turned out to be very wrong about that.
Well, and Ernst Zundel had his house firebombed, and he was thrown in prison.
Zundel has had it the worst, because when he did try to surrender, they still pulled him back. When Zundel moved to Tennessee to be with his wife, who's an American, Ingrid, when he moved to Tennessee, that was a little bit of a white flag that he was raising, and I'm not saying that in a derogatory way. I just mean that Ernst realized at that stage of his life the threats, the harassment, and the constant attempts by the government to put him in prison. He wanted to pull back a little bit. He envisioned a life of retirement in the hills of Tennessee in Pigeon Forge. He envisioned a life of retirement where he'd still be active online and his website and things like that, but the Canadians, with the American government's assistance, the Canadians pulled him right back into Canada, threw him in a little tin can of a cell for a couple of years, and then sent him back to Germany, where he hadn't lived since he was a young boy. So that he tried to give up. That's what, you know, when you talk about the taboo nature of this subject, Ryan, level of hatred is so strong against historical revisionists who tackle this topic that they won't forgive you. They won't let you go. Germar Rudolf made it all the way to Chicago. He was in London for a while. He was in Spain for a while. Then he went to Mexico for a while. Then he landed in Chicago. He married an American woman, not a marriage of immigration convenience, but very much a marriage of love. They had a beautiful child together. And the German government still wouldn't let the guy alone. The irony, I mean, the thing that's just tragic about
it. We're saying the wrong thing. This is true thought.
Yes, exactly. Because, and the thing is, what I can do, what Germar can do, what any of the good revisionists can do, is, you know, you give us 15 minutes and we can very rationally explain our point of view. And at no point does anything we say have to do with harming Jews or hating Jews or hating anyone? I've said this before many times. Look, I'm either right or I'm wrong, or maybe I'm half right about this gas chamber or that gas chamber or this camp or that camp or this Fuhrer order or that Fuhrer order. But none of it has to do with hatred. And if people think I'm wrong, people think Germar Rudolph is wrong, well, you prove us wrong. I've never known a revisionist scholar who says anything different than just prove me wrong.
Yeah, and that's how it should be. But you'll see, I think the problem is people have their personal identities wrapped up in the war, in the certain narrative, and view themselves with the victimhood status of this or that. And you see that in a smaller degree with some other wars, and there's a little bit of taboo with, say, the Civil War. If you criticize Lincoln, then you're a racist or something, or even Barack Obama. If you don't like him, it couldn't possibly because of his banker bailouts and imperial escapades. It's because he's black or something. But most people understand that that's ridiculous, that, of course, you can criticize these things. You can even criticize Israel, and it's hard to do, and people will call you anti-Semitic for that. But you say, well, maybe it's because of, you know, the ethnic cleansing and racial settlements they build in Palestine and so on. Or even if you criticize Islam, it doesn't mean you're Islamophobic. Maybe you have legitimate criticisms, but nothing has the taboo around it like the Holocaust. And from my mind, I was excited and happy to know that, or to believe that 6 million people weren't really burned to death in ovens. That was good news. And had nothing, I don't have a stake in it, you know, but, nobody wants to tackle that. And also politically, the U.S. needs World War II to be the good war so that it can create new Hitlers in the future to justify future conflicts.
Well, the myth of World War II as the good war, that's an incredibly, pervasive myth that is very important to Western governments, specifically to the United States and England. It's a very, very important myth. And in fact, that's one of the reasons, one of the things that I found is putting aside what I say about the gas chambers and and what happened at Auschwitz or didn't happen at Auschwitz, I would get into trouble even by making an incredibly defensible point that even if you read every mainstream Holocaust book, there's agreement that at the end of 1944, if you buy the whole extermination program story, which I don't, but even if you do, there's general agreement that Himmler called it off at the end of 44. That alone is controversial to say because we want to believe it was going on right up until our troops liberated everybody. You know, we literally plucked people right out of the gas chambers. That's part of the myth, we stopped the Holocaust. So, you know, first you have to have this mainstream version of the Holocaust and the 6 million. Then you have to have the idea that we stopped it. We did it. And I'm not trying to denigrate the service members who were liberators, and I'm not trying to excuse the terrible conditions that they found in the camps. But this is one of the reasons that even some so-called respectable scholars will totally fudge the info regarding the camps as our troops found them in April, March and April of 45. People will see those pictures, and they're terrible pictures, of course. Typhus does horrible things to the human body. Dysentery, these are terrible things for anyone to have to deal with, and yet the evidence is fudged where people say, well, I know that there was a gas chamber program because I've seen the pictures. I've seen the pictures of those skeletal people. And
thing that come to mind there when you see everybody so emaciated like that is starvation, which was pervasive throughout the war in many areas, including Allied territories, where millions of people starved to death. But that's not the same thing as a program to exterminate people. And also in the Pacific side, you saw the U.S. go in after the bombings in Japan and confiscate the color footage from their own army and confiscating the film from the Japanese to make sure that the narrative on that stayed the way they wanted it, and nobody was allowed to tackle that either.
One of the questions I would often get, because if I get into a discussion with people about Bergen-Belsen or Dachau, and I point out, for example, that at Bergen-Belsen, the SS pretty much fled the camp at the end of the war, and the inmates were kind of trying to run things themselves the best they could with very little resources. And people would say to me, oh, really, David? Then why didn't they just run away? Why would they stay there? Why would that be where we found them? And the two points I would make is, point number one, we had bombed Germany back into the Stone Age. So when people say, why didn't they run away? Run to where? Everything was pure desolation and destruction around them. But at least if you were in a camp, you knew that you would not get bombed, and you knew that eventually the Red Cross would show up and you would get help, help that was not being given at that point to ordinary Germans in dire circumstances. So when the Red Cross and the British Army did enter Bergen-Belsen, the inmates there could have left for weeks, according to the testimony of a fellow named Dr. Russell Barton, who was one of the Red Cross doctors who came into the camp. They stayed there because it was out of two bad situations. It was generally considered that this was the less bad of two bad. It wasn't like the inmates had a great choice either way. The war presented that to so many people. Well, you don't get a good choice and a bad choice, just a bad choice and maybe a slightly lesser bad choice. And of course, one other thing to point out is World War II. One thing that makes it unique is that it's a war with an ex post facto reason for being. The whole shebang was started supposedly to keep Poland independent. And when it became clear at the end of the war that Stalin had no desires to keep Poland independent, those pictures, those photographs, the film of Belsen, Dachau, Oranienburg, and the other camps, they took on a massive importance because they now became the reason for the war, even though the war started long before any of this happened. But people at home, in the United States, people in England, they needed to be told, this is why we fought. Not a lot of people go back and do the math and say, wait a minute, the war technically starts in 39 and then the shooting starts in 1940 and then 41, it explodes into a world conflagration. None of this concentration camp stuff in terms of the what we saw at Dachau and Belsen, none of that had happened yet. There was already a Dachau, but it was being used primarily for German political prisoners, German citizens. But the Holocaust notion happened much later. But a lot of people just don't like doing that math of, wait a minute, if this is the reason we fought, but it happened after the war got started. Those are things that the average history teacher just doesn't want you to think about.
It's also disturbing how the Holocaust is called the Holocaust. That word was made just for the event, as with genocide, but it wasn't the only, if you take the official narrative, it wouldn't have been the only event in history where millions of people were wiped out because of their ethnicity or religion. That was happening in India during World War II. It was happening in the Congo, and it's happened in many places, Native Americans, etc., where millions of people have been wiped off the earth, but they are not seen as the epitome of evil. You don't have Godwin's Law for those events. It's only for World War II. And I guess that's because it's so important to the Western governments, because in that story, they're the good guys.
Yeah, and also among Jews, and I always like to be careful when I go into that territory, but you have to. You have to say the word Jew if you're talking about Holocaust-related issues. And among Jews, there's been attached a kind of religious iconic value to the 6 million figure, to the extent that going below it, even by just a couple of million, is seen as blasphemy. Raoul Hilberg, who was generally respected as the leader in the field of Holocaust history during his lifetime, Raoul Hilberg made that point in a 1986 Jerusalem Post article, sadly, because we don't have we didn't have the internet back then, that this was something we would just pass along to each other, hard copy. Hey, let me mail you this article. Now I'll photocopy it, mail it to you. But it was a very interesting article from 86 where Hilberg says, we know that the figure is definitely under 6 million. And frankly, it's probably under 5 million too, but everyone's scared to go there. I'm paraphrasing him, of course, because I don't have the article in front of me, but he's essentially saying, among his group of scholars, there's a fear, that we might just have to go under the 5 million figure. And so, of course, no one really did. Occasionally people will make statements about the unreliability of the numbers, but that 6 million figure, just, it has this iconic value. And quite a few Jewish authors over the years have criticized this religious iconic importance that has been attached to Holocaust in general and the figures specifically.
It was a figure that had been propping up in newspapers prior to the war, during World War I even, and before the number could possibly have been determined, it had already been determined in the papers as 6 million because it fulfills a kind of religious prophecy.
Yeah.
That had been in there. So it's suspicious to have the nice round number like that. And it doesn't matter, I want to make clear to everyone, it doesn't matter if it was 6 million, 1 million, or 100,000. It's horrible anyway. But just as historians, the truth credentials of it, the truth of it, does matter. We're not trying to downplay crimes of Nazis or anyone else. It's just that you should have the freedom to be able to talk about these things. And it also matters in terms of reparations and other events afterward, exactly how many people were killed and how it happened. Because it really pulls the face off of this war being the good war when you see evil versus evil rather than this kind of ridiculous good guy versus the bad guys narrative.
Well, I'd like to tell a very brief anecdote that I think illustrates the positive side of what I was trying to do, because there are many ways in which what I felt that I was doing was positive. One of them just being that it's positive to be truthful. It's for a historian, for a doctor, for a scientist, guy's much brighter than me, but regardless, it's always positive to be truthful. Hell, I think we all find that out in our personal relationships. You tell a lie to your girlfriend, it's going to catch up with you. You just know it will. It's just always good to be truthful. But there is another positive point about what I was doing. And here's the anecdote I'll tell very briefly. When Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review and I appeared on the Montel Williams show in early 1992. I think it was February of 92. The Montel Williams producer brought on to debate us this gentleman named Ernest Hollander. Now, one of the things that I'm very, very set in my, in this is something that I feel I've researched the heck out of, and that's that there was no gassing program at Auschwitz ever, but also not in summer of 44 when the Hungarian and some Czech Jews as well were sent there in large numbers. That's the crux of Auschwitz, by the way. Auschwitz is 1944. That's where the bulk of all the supposed murders happen. And that's one of the things that I go into much more detail about in my book. But if you talk about Auschwitz and you talk about gas chambers, you're talking about 1944. I am, by the way, I do feel that the commandant, Hirsch, did kill people, not from orders from above. He was actually a very corrupt man who was being investigated and indeed was removed from duty by the SS, by their own internal system. So I'm not saying that no murders happened in Auschwitz, because Hirsch was not a good guy. I mean, number one, he's a concentration camp commandant. So it takes a certain kind of person mindset to do that kind of thing to other people. But on top of that, he was just a really bad guy, even on top of that other stuff. So because my point about the 1944 Jews sent to Auschwitz, the producer of the Montel Williams show brings on one of the 1944 Jews this Ernest Hollander fellow, who was sent to Auschwitz with his family in 1944. And indeed, there were huge numbers of Jews sent to Auschwitz in 44 for labor, quite clearly for labor. But anyway, so this Hollander fellow, older man, who went through something very bad when he was young. I mean, he was plucked from his home and sent to Auschwitz. And he's very angry at me on the show. And he has, I understand that. I didn't argue with him. I didn't take him on because there's no way you can look good in that situation yelling back at a gentleman like that. But he's saying he knows his brother was killed. He knows his brother was killed. How can I say that his brother was not killed? His brother was killed. Now, dare I deny that? Now, the Montel Williams show airs, and it airs all over the country, and a guy's watching it in New York City. And the guy says, huh, this Ernest Hollander fellow looks remarkably like my upstairs neighbor, Zoltan Hollander, who just emigrated here, just came here from the old Soviet Union. I think I'll go ask him to turn on the channel. Bottom line is, it turns out the brother was alive, living in New York. He had been caught on the wrong side of the Iron Curtain at the end of the war. And what had happened was because the Western governments and the Soviet government had told Jews, the 1944 Jews, if you're not with your family member, that means they're dead. They were all killed. If you were lucky enough to get away, you're the only one. So don't even bother looking for your family members, because if you didn't have them with you at the end of the war, wherever you were liberated, then they're gone. So both brothers, one brother on one side of the Iron Curtain, the other brother on the other side, both brothers had been told that their brother was dead, murdered in 1944 at Auschwitz. The stubbornness of the historical community in not entertaining the possibility of a different scenario in 1944 at Auschwitz led to untold thousands of people thinking that their relatives were dead and not even bothering to look for them. And of course, the Soviet Union made it hard to do that anyway, because for a long period of time, for many decades, Western scholars couldn't go over there and freely research. Back in 1991, 92, there could have been a lot more of these reunions. Because think about the odds, Ryan. The one Jew they bring on the show to debate me, the one 1944 Jew that they randomly choose, just so happens to prove my point. What are the odds of that? There were probably a lot of other Jews who back then could have had happy reunions. The Montel Williams show had the reunion of the two brothers on its program. Needless to say, I was not invited. I was not thanked. Mark Weber was not thanked. And when the AP covered the reunion, they said, the irony is that these two brothers were reunited because one of them was debating a neo-Nazi. Yeah. And that's the thanks I get. I mean, not that I'm asking them to thank me. I'm just saying, so that's what I'm proven right on the show. And technically, theoretically, scholars should be like, huh, maybe we'll look into this. But instead, I'm just dismissed as a neo-Nazi. You can see that Montel show online, and you can comb through every single word, every grunt, every pause, everything I do, and there's not a thing even remotely neo-Nazi, pro-Nazi, pro-old Nazi, nothing that I say. But anyway, that I just wanted to bring up that back then, there was the real chance of having more of these reunions, except people like Weber and I were shut out of the process for the most part.
That's really tragic, just to hold on to their story. They could have at least, after that epic reunion, said, okay, now that this has happened, maybe we ought to do a program on that and see, or, you know, get the word out. But of course that didn't happen. Of course.
Yeah. It was really a tremendous tragedy, because now it's kind of too late. Now that 22 years have passed, the likelihood of those reunions has diminished greatly, which is very sad. Slowly but surely, I got squeezed out after the Montel show, and I did about three or four other shows And that just increased the voluminous hatred I was getting, and the threats and the attacks. And I stuck in there until about 96. And that's when, for a variety of reasons, I decided I had to pull back for a bit.
Well, you'll get ostracized in the community as well, because people don't want to associate with someone who's accused of being a neo-Nazi, even though you're clearly not. It doesn't matter how rational your case is or anything. The stigma of it is just so poisonous. It's like being if you're an atheist in a lot of parts of the country, you can't run for office. Just on that alone, you're just never going to be elected because you don't believe in Jesus or whatever. No matter how nice you are, no matter how intelligent you are, that prejudice is there. Because if you don't believe in God, you must believe in Satan or something. Even if you just think that the whole story is childish and ridiculous or something.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a very good analogy, because it comes down to a faith-based belief, and so too does a lot of the elements of the Holocaust that people get the most angry about when I attempt to revise them, or at least attempt to question them, or at least attempt to write critically about them.
You don't believe in my story? Devil worshiper. Yeah. You don't believe in my story? Nazi.
Yeah, I got a little angry at some of the friends who ostracized me this time after my outing last year, because I said to one of them, one of the few who would still actually speak to me, and I said, I was, this is a terrible thing, Ryan, but I was outed on April 20th. Now, some of your listeners will get the import of that date.
Well, that was Columbine.
So
Hitler's birthday.
Hitler's birthday, yeah. And the people who outed me, I don't believe they consciously chose that date. It just so happened to be the date of a function where they could spread the word about me. But I was getting angry at one of the people who was ostracizing me, and I said, when you went to bed April 19th, did you even know what the term Crema 2, Crema 3 means? Did you even know how many Cremas there were supposed to have been at Auschwitz main camp and at Auschwitz-Birkenau? Did you know that? Because today it's the most important thing in the world to you, apparently. If I had said to you on April 19th, you know, there were 28 Cremas, or if I had said there were 2 Cremas, if I had said there were 18 Cremas, you would have trusted me as an intelligent, scholarly person, and you wouldn't have gotten angry. And now that it, after April 20th, and now that you're told to dislike me by our circle of friends, now the number of Cremas is of incredible importance to you. These details never mattered to any of these folks before my outing, and then all of a sudden it just became the most important thing in the world to them. Oh, wait, he says that there was no gassings at Majdanek. You can't even pronounce the damn camp name. And yet it's of incredible importance to you that I say that, yes, there was no gassing program at Majdanek. People weren't even, they didn't even know what they're supposed to be angry about. They just knew they were supposed to be angry.
Yeah, well, let's get into that, into what you believe and disbelieve, and I'll start with some of the more theatrical post-war propaganda about soap, lampshades, human hair stuff, mattresses, all of that. Can you explain what that really was and how those rumors were so pervasive? I mean, those are no longer held onto anymore by scholars or historians, but that myth is still pervasive in the general public, where they believe that those things were carried out.
That was all part of the immediate post-war propaganda material. Specifically the British and the U.S., the Western powers. The British and the U.S. had the misfortune of not actually being able to liberate one of the supposed final solution camps. The Soviets got to liberate Auschwitz and Majdanek and the bare ground where Treblinka used to be and Sobibor. So they had a lot to show off, specifically at Auschwitz, which was captured very intact. Majdanek was captured fairly intact as well. the U.S. government really wanted to get in on that propaganda fund, but they didn't have the visuals that the Soviets had. So stuff that was legitimate, like the dying people, typhus and dysentery, those pictures were made into something that they weren't really. And then other stuff, the soap rumor had been around all throughout the war. The soap rumor has its roots in even older war propaganda, and it kind of came back, fueled a lot by frightened inmates hearing stuff from other inmates who hear stuff from other inmates. The soap rumor was in the New York Times during the war, but after the war, our government looked for anything that it could find. Lampshade, oh, that's a human lampshade. Now, there were definitely commandants, very much like Hirsch at Auschwitz, there were commandants who were pretty kinky and a little crazy. There's actually quite a long list of commandants who were arrested or executed by the SS during the war itself. So there, the U.S. government had the benefit of the fact that some of the commandants actually were into some wacky stuff, and that made it easy for them to find things to exploit. However, the lampshade thing was long afterwards was proven to be phony. The soap thing was completely phony. But here's an example of how pervasive propaganda can be. When the New York Times and all the other Western papers on the Allied side were screaming about the human soap during the war, there was a point where Himmler actually asked some of his underlings, "We're not doing that, are we? Are any of our guys doing that?" Of course, again, I'm paraphrasing, but the propaganda got so huge during the war that Himmler himself wanted to make sure that there was a particular brigade called the Dirlewanger Brigade where the head guy was a little crazy and was known to do some. He was kind of almost a German version of the Brad Pitt Inglourious Bastards character. I mean, he'd scalp you if he could.
Like our guys in Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, exactly. He was known to be violent, sadistic, and over the top. So Himmler acted with all that soap propaganda going around. Himmler actually ordered an internal investigation just to make sure that none of this was going on behind his back, and it wasn't. But the thing that
extremely hard to pull off, because it's not a very cost efficient operation, and you'd need factories, and it would be very hard to. It's not something you can do in your basement or something, but
yeah, exactly. And the thing that the U.S. government and the U.S. Army did, though, that was the most dramatic in terms of misrepresenting evidence after the war, was building a phony gas chamber at Dachau. They built it in advance of a visit from U.S. senators and congresspeople who were going to come to Munich, and they were going to tour the Dachau terror factory. And the army wanted a gas chamber there. Damn it. They wanted to show off a gas chamber. Now, this is, Ryan, the most open secret in mainstream Holocaust history. When I became known as Stein and started mixing with the opposite set of people from the revisionists, everyone admits this. Everybody admits that chamber is as fake as a theater set. It was a simple shower room that where the army built phony shower heads to cover the real ones, with no thought towards how the gas would be introduced into the room or anything like that. But what was splashed on the newspapers, though, when the senators got there, with U.S. senators tore gas chamber, Dachau, factory of terrorists with its gas chamber. And the British did the same thing. The British produced propaganda films, one of them narrated by Trevor Howard, one of them produced by Alfred Hitchcock. Same thing, Dachau, the gas chamber, Dachau. Now, this should have been revised decades ago. The soap has been revised. You talk to people about the soap story. I mean, you talk to mainstream historians about the soap story. They agree that didn't happen. Same with the lampshade story.
Well, the Allies exacerbated those wartime myths because they actually brought in most of the city of Weimar into Buchenwald, and they had a little display table up there.
Oh, yeah.
With some fake soap, fake lampshade, shrunken heads, pelvis ashtray, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even brought in Billy Wilder, you know, Marilyn Monroe,
of course,
Hollywood
mm-hmm.
guru,
yeah.
C.D. Jackson of the psych war department, and had a show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The army spread that all around Germany and basically said, browbeated normal Germans into believing that this is what had been happening at these camps. But the funny thing about the... there's nothing funny about any of this, but the interesting thing about the Dachau gas chamber is that rather than being revised as it should have been, the mainstream historical community decided to strike a compromise of sorts where they would still say it's a gas chamber, but they would say it was never used. And that's what the sign has said there since about the 80s, like the mid to late 80s. The sign inside that room says, Dachau gas chamber, never used. This is, to me, how ridiculous things get when you try to compromise with the truth.
I think the point of that is probably because they don't want anybody testing physically for gas and not finding it, so they have to go ahead and explain it now before anybody tries that.
Exactly. And what it means, though, if you break that argument down, which I do in my book, if you break the argument down, what it means is that the Germans running this camp took a perfectly necessary shower room because all concentration camps had shower rooms in them. Lice was always a problem. Disease was always a problem. So every single camp had a shower room, and the shower room was usually in the same complex where the gas chambers for clothes were, the chambers to delouse clothes, and also the other areas where people would sometimes be deloused with, not with Zyklon B in most of the camps, but with a kind of German version of DDT. And so what we're supposed to believe about Dachau is that the Germans take a perfectly necessary shower room, build a phony ceiling on it so that it can no longer be used as a shower room, but then don't use it as a gas chamber. They've taken their one main shower room and they've made it unusable as a shower room, but also they're not using it as a gas chamber. Basically, they took one big room and decided we're just going to actually make this room unusable for anything. There's no logic
to
that.
German engineers are, right?
Yeah, exactly. There's no logic to it, Ryan, but that's what credentialed PhDs will want you to believe. And that's where it just gets very surreal when you realize this is what you're told, to buy into, that, oh, they just decided to throw a perfectly good room away, no longer using it as a shower, but never using it as a gas chamber. So it just collected dust for 3 years. It's a silly, silly claim.
And propaganda is what it is. But let me ask you something about how many camps were there and how many were liberated, but not by the Russians, but by, say, the British and Americans, that none of which had any gas chambers to the point where they decided to build one to compete with Russia's propaganda.
Well, there is one camp that was liberated by the Western Allies that did have a gas chamber in it. It was a small camp called Notzweiler in Alsace-Lorraine. And I made this point way back in the early 90s. Notzweiler is it's a very interesting camp to study because it's the only place where there is, in my opinion, an actual gas chamber that you can go study. What there is at Notzweiler, when you study it, strengthens the revisionist cause, because what you find at Notzweiler is a full paper trail covering the construction of the gas chamber, the requisition for it, the shipment of inmates to it, the bodies after they were gassed, and the chamber is still there and can be examined for ventilation and such. Now, this was a minor instance in the war. There was a doctor in Strasbourg, a Nazi doctor, who went a little nuts after his family was killed in an Allied bombing raid. And this doctor, Dr. Hurt, with an I, H-I-R-T, but yet it's kind of an appropriate name, Dr. Hurt decided he wanted to deflesh the skulls of 100 Bolshevist Jews. And this is his turn. This is what he requisitioned. So he wanted Jews shipped to him at his scientific institute in Strasbourg. He wanted Jews shipped to him that had not been shot in the head. He wanted their skulls intact, 100 of them. And he requisitions them from Auschwitz. Now, if Auschwitz was the death factory with all the gas chambers, Hurt would have gotten word back saying, sure, we'll get 100 non-shot bodies on a train to you immediately. But in fact, Auschwitz they couldn't do it there. So that's why at the Nutzweiler camp, a special chamber had to be built just for this Dr. Hurt's crazy little experiment. They took a room that had been used by the SS as a tear gas training room. And, you know, that's something law enforcement does to this day and has always done. And the army's always done. You're stuck in the bunch of the recruits or whoever is stuck in a room and the tear gas is put in. You have to learn how to put your gas mask on and function among tear gas. So they took a room that already was airtight and had ventilation. And they shipped live Jews over from Auschwitz. And then in three batches, they were slightly under 100. I believe there's 98 altogether that came. In three batches, the Jews were indeed gassed. And there's a paper trail, an unassailable paper trail covering this entire thing, which is very important because one of the arguments against revisionists, people say to me, oh, the reason there's no paper trail is they burned it. They got rid of all the paper trail, or they never did it. They only passed along their orders orally. And you hear that all the time. I hear that, I should say, all the time. But in fact, at Nutzweiler, the paper trail survived fully intact. Dr. Hurt saying he wants these 100 Jews. Dr. Hurt saying, okay, we've got to build chamber here for them. Dr. Hurt and the camp, the director of the camp saying, okay, we'll use this room. We'll build a gas chamber and tell me how you want to build it. The Jews arriving, the Jews being processed, the Jews being killed. And then the bodies, interestingly enough, Dr. Hurt never actually got around to defleshing most of them. When the Allies went to the Scientific Institute, they found most of the bodies still in cold storage. And because of their Auschwitz tattoo, they were identifiable because they hadn't been defleshed yet. So I'm making that point to say that when it did happen in that instance, there was a full-on paper trail and physical evidence and bodies, the whole thing. But the Allies being dumb about all of this, they could have used that room at Nutzweiler and for their post-war propaganda, and they actually would have been more or less correct. But they didn't care about looking into the facts, and really it wasn't until the 1970s that anyone started to do any work about the Nutzweiler camp. The Allies wanted to be clumsy. They didn't care about facts. So that's why they took Dachau, which was probably the most well-known camp because it was the oldest. And they took Dachau and they decided this is where we're going to say the gassings were. And also Mauthausen, another camp that they used in Austria, where there was absolutely no gas chamber. You can't tell that to, you can't tell that to most Holocaust historians, even though you go there and it's just clearly a shower room. And that's one of the things that I used to show in my videos. My apologies for my phone ringing in the back. I should have taken.
It happens. You're still coming in clear. But even in Auschwitz, and I've seen your video where you were there too, the gas chamber at Auschwitz was reconstructed after the war.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that the Soviets did almost immediately. Upon liberation, what we call Crema 1, which was the original crematorium complex at the Auschwitz main camp, Crema One was a very simple crematorium complex and bomb shelter, air raid shelter. It's partially underground, and it's built with every marking of a of an air raid shelter. It has a blast wall inside of it on the other side of the door. In other words, so if the door is blown off its hinges, there is a wall still protecting the people inside. And it has, and this is one of my, couple of my unique contributions to it. It locks on the inside, which no one had pointed out until I just decided to take a look at the locks on the door. The doors lock on the inside, not the outside. The doors open into the room, not out of the room. And the point of that, of course, is if bodies are piled up against the door trying to get out, as we're told would happen in a gas chamber, you couldn't open a door that opens into the room. The door would have to open out so that you could pull bodies out. But most importantly, one of the things I found is that that room has the supposed gas chamber in Crema One has an escape hatch. It has a large square concrete manhole cover. This was standard procedure with air raid shelters, because if the front, if the doors become blown up or blocked by wreckage, or if part of the complex collapses, the people inside need a way out. And so it was fairly standard procedure to have an escape hatch that would lead to an open field somewhere close by where people could climb out and there wouldn't be rubble on top of it. The notion of a gas chamber with an escape hatch is beyond surreal. There's just no words for it. But the Soviets took that building, which was completely intact, and they remodeled it. They knocked down walls. They took out the sewer, the toilet and sink facilities. They turned it into what they claimed was a gas chamber. They poked four holes in the ceiling where the Zyklon would be poured in. And it's as phony as a $15 bill. I mean, it's just completely, completely fake. But the people in the West would fake such a thing. Well, because even though they captured Majdanek and Auschwitz fairly intact, they didn't have actual real gas chambers to show. What they had, however, were rooms where heavy Zyklon B usage was used. At Majdanek, for example, they had rooms where there was definite blue staining on the walls that you get from Zyklon B usage. And Auschwitz had already been rendered infamous in the press, both the Soviet and the Western press, during the war. So, and it was, Auschwitz was known as a place where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews went to. Dachau was never primarily a Jewish camp. Dachau started out as a camp for German political dissidents. At the end of the war, Jews were shipped there, and other people were shipped there because there was, the Germans were trying to consolidate their labor force. But Dachau was never primarily a Jewish camp. Auschwitz was known as the Jewish camp. And it was a fearful reputation, to the extent that when the Jews of Hungary were going to be deported in 1944, the Hungarian Jews would do anything not to be. I mean, they'd bribe their way out. They'd try to escape. Well-placed Hungarian Jews would even sometimes turn over their own fellow Jews in order to secure an escape for themselves. Auschwitz had a fearful, fearful reputation, in part because of the propaganda. So when the Soviets liberate it, generally intact, for the most part intact, the main camp especially is entirely intact. Birkenau, the area where most of the Jews were, was not entirely intact. But when the Auschwitz liberated, it's just a natural. And I would, in all honesty, Ryan, as much as I want to ascribe the worst possible motivations to the Soviets because they were among the worst possible group of people, I would say that probably a fair amount of them believed that there were gas chambers in Auschwitz and believed that all they were doing was building a replica of something that had existed. I don't think they were all mustache twirling commissars who thought they were doing bad. I think there was a certain amount of them who thought, well, yeah, there was a gas chamber here, and all we're doing is bringing it back to life to show people the horrors of what happened.
It just seems like reconstructing a gas chamber that wasn't actually a gas chamber, like to create one and then say that it was an original one, will really discredit the entire story more than add credibility towards it.
Of course, but you also have to put yourself in the mindset of a Soviet soldier or commander in 1945. I don't think they felt that they'd ever have to answer for this, because the mindset at that time was the Soviets were going to take over most of Europe. Certainly they were going to take over all of the East, which they did for quite a while. I don't think any of them were looking ahead. In fact, I think if you would have told any of those people back in 45 that by the early 90s, Americans will be coming over and snooping around, I don't think they would have believed it. There was a sense of their own invincibility at that point, and that there was a sense that the future was communist, the future was Soviet. So I don't think they ever felt there'd be such a critical eye ever put on the work they did. And when revisionists began going there in the late 80s, mid 80s, and through the early 90s, I think this was not expected by the people who did that work in 45 and 46. I think that you have to, that's part of the Soviet mentality of that era. I just they felt the future was theirs, and that there'd be no explaining they'd ever have to do.
Well, I mean, there was plenty of war propaganda that was complete bull that they'd gotten away with already, so why not?
Yeah, and one of the few times that they lost a propaganda fight was at the main Nuremberg trial. The Soviets wanted it run Soviet style, which is where you hang everybody and then you explain the evidence as to why you hang them. The British and the Americans wanted at least the veneer of a respectable trial. Now, being very clear here, the Nuremberg trial would not hold up by any civilized evidentiary standards. But the British and the Americans wanted at least a veneer of respectability to it, whereas the Soviets were like, no, we hang them. We hang them now. And then we say why we hang them. The fact that two people were acquitted at the main Nuremberg trial is astounding, because the Soviets wanted all of them hanged. And the fact that some people drew less sentences than death, and some people and two people were actually acquitted, including Schacht, the former economics minister for the German state, the Soviets were incensed about that. What, we're letting two of them go? That's not how Soviet justice works. So a small defeat for the Soviets was the fact that not everybody at the main Nuremberg trial was instantaneously hanged. And the fact that there had to be evidence and cross-examination. Very funny story. In the 90s, I forget what year, maybe 94, 95. I believe it was TNT, the cable channel, did a movie about the main Nuremberg trial, starring Alec Baldwin as the American prosecutor, and a wonderful Scottish actor named Brian Cox played Goering. And TNT made a big deal about saying that all of the cross-examinations will be taken directly from the transcript. That was the gimmick. Like the courtroom scenes will be verbatim from the transcript. And Alec Baldwin was being interviewed by TV Guide in advance of the TV movie coming out. And he said that they ended up actually having to rewrite part of the trial transcript for the movie, because Goering was scoring too many points off the prosecutor, to the extent that the people doing the TV movie are like, he's making good points. We can't show that. We can't put that on the air. But the very fact that there were those vigorous cross-examinations where people like Goering actually did get a chance to speak freely on the stand, the Soviets didn't want that either. And the transcripts are fascinating. I recommend to anyone with an interest in history to try to get your hands either online or at a good library somewhere. Try to get your hands on the transcripts of the main Nuremberg trial.
Some footage of it, too, because I remember we watched some of that in a history class at William & Mary at college, and as soon as it got to those points where they're making these great points, the teacher pulled the plug. Of course, I was like, wait a minute, I was interested in that. That's because really, they need the Holocaust to have war crimes tribunals because the Allied powers, especially the Soviets, are guilty of everything they accused the Nazis of doing, because they were. They're all guilty of killing civilians, starving people, torture, etc. Everything. They've all done it. And the only difference between the Nazis and everyone else is this very specific event of the Holocaust with gassings and ovens and all the other propaganda about soap and so forth.
Well, that's entirely true, Ryan. And in fact, if you look at the main charge at Nuremberg, which was waging aggressive war, well, you know, I think we can think of a lot of examples of the U.S. and other governments waging aggressive war. I mean, that was the name of the charge, waging aggressive war. And
by colonial powers that had carved up about 25% of the earth.
Yeah, exactly. So the whole thing was an exercise in hypocrisy. But that's why, like you said, the Holocaust official story becomes incredibly important for both, as we said earlier, the myth of the good war and the thing that separated us from those evil Huns who did real bad things. And even if we might have not been perfect and squeaky clean, oh, but at least we didn't do that. We didn't have assembly line gas chambers and kill 6 million people, then undress their bodies or undress them first. The story, of course, always changes. But we do need that myth. And in fact, even politically, even getting beside military industrial stuff and international warfare, even on a smaller level, hating me, and this is one of the things that I found out since I was outed, hating a guy like me is something that brings Republicans and Democrats together. Whenever you have political parties that will argue, and the public will often say, there's too much arguing, too much name calling. It's good to have something that brings everyone together. And disliking Holocaust revisionists is something where the Republicans and the Democrats, and also, unfortunately, a lot of libertarians and a lot of people in other who are not non-committed in one way or the other. But it's like, you know what? We might disagree on a lot, but boy, we all hate this guy. And, you know, let's shake our hands about our wonderful nonpartisanship. There's always a need in society for the person or people that everybody can just sort of come together to dislike. That's why most of my former Republican friends, I mean, Republicans who are former friends, jumped on the bandwagon so quickly when I was outed, almost like they were trying to prove to the country that look how quickly we will attack this guy and ban him. And
it's associated with racism. Like, if you question the amount of deaths of such and such, and you say it's any lower than what's claimed, then your only motivation possible must be that you're a racist. And with other wars, if you look at the babies on incubators myth from Gulf War I, which also is, you know, You can claim there's an ethnic component to it, the Kuwaitis getting killed or whatever, but of course it didn't happen, and it was a Hilton Knowlton, you know, PR firm myth promoted by Tom Lantos and etc. But nobody was really held accountable for that, and it led to a war in Iraq, which then led to the oil for food program and 500,000 people starving to death, which is also a Holocaust, most of them children. And then later another war that was based on deception. And yet, if you say that, I mean, a lot of Democrats, libertarians, and some Republicans can acknowledge, that was false. You know, that was a myth. There weren't any babies on incubators. But we had these other reasons we should have done anyway. They can rationalize it if they want. But no one's going to call you racist for saying or saying you're pro Saddam or something just because you point out that testimony was false.
Yeah.
Or that you hate Kuwaitis or something. Like, no, I don't hate Kuwaitis. It's just that that was false.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and that's, we get into that terrible death spiral that revisionists get into where you're just called every name in the book racist, Nazi, just like the AP called me and Mark Weber neo-Nazis when we were on the Montel show. And there's nothing that really can't be said about a revisionist. And the interesting parallel there is there's also really nothing that can't be said about the Holocaust because no one questions it. You can say, oh, at so-and-so camp. Well, this is a real story. The true story, Ryan, that people used to say, and it's probably you'd still find it online, people spreading it, that at, I believe it was Treblinka, they'd throw a Jew in a cage with a bear and either an eagle, I think it was an eagle, and the eagle would pluck out the Jew's eyes, and then the bear would eat the Jew. Now this is not something I'm making up, and when I heard that story the first time,
I said, something out of a Lewis Libby book.
Yeah, well, I said to myself, well, why didn't the bear just eat the eagle? How did the bear and the eagle so neatly have a division of labor between them?
Because they're anti-Semitic, baby.
Yeah. But you can really say anything. People now, they say, oh, the numbers are increasing. It's now 6.5 million, 7 million. When at this camp,
well, it's like 20 million now.
Yeah.
According to the New York Times author with the electric floors and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And there were stories of German shepherds trained only to eat the testicles of Jews, and Dr. Mengele having an actual wall of eyeballs that he would pluck out of inmates in order to make an entire wall of nothing but Jewish eyeballs. And that when people get so uncritical about any subject, and it could be absolutely anything, it doesn't have to be World War II, it could be anything. When people get that uncritical that they will accept anything, it's dangerous. It's dangerous for the very foundations of history as a discipline. When your people get uncritical and then they lash out at the people who are being critical. In LA where I live, there is something called the Simon Wiesenthal Center Museum of Tolerance. And this place.
Moron. Sorry.
Oh gosh. It's so bad that when it opened, even a couple of Jewish publications, locally went after it. Because it's that bad. It's bad all around. It's a Disneyland with animatronic figures supposedly teaching tolerance. But in fact, it's a Holocaust museum. The Wiesenthal Center wanted city money to help build it back in the late 80s. And, the city, said it would be easier to funnel taxpayer money to the museum if it was about like everyone's tragedies, the Armenians and the Indians and everything. So it was renamed from the Holocaust Museum to the Museum of Tolerance, and they tacked on a really bad front room that's about tolerance. But after you get through that room, the whole museum is just about the Holocaust, and they shovel the most ridiculous nonsense at people. But unfortunately, and you can see this if you drive down Pico Boulevard on the west side any school day, you'll see they bus kids in there every single day during the school year. They make kids, public school kids,
that in DC to go look at the mountains of human hair and shoes and things
like that.
Never talk about Laos or anything, like nothing, just you're led to assume that they shaved all their heads and then killed them. And it never made sense to me, even as a child, if it was a death camp, why they weren't all dead on the first day. It doesn't take that long to just shoot somebody, but...
Yeah. But again, this is how the propagandists misuse things. The hair was shaved because of the the lice problem. The hair was shaved to, in an attempt to try to keep the inmates healthy. And again, not to defend it. It's a terrible thing to be sent to a camp, and especially if you're a woman. And
healthy to force them to work to death.
Yeah, exactly. And then the Germans, being resourceful, they actually used a lot of the hair. That was sort of the nature of their war effort, our war effort as well. But nothing got wasted. A lot of that human hair was used to make slippers for submarine crews, because one of the important things on a submarine is when you walk around, you can't make any kind of a ping or a noise that can register. So even a lot of the hair was used. But there was a process, and it was a terrible process. Like you said, exploitative, and it was all in the service of forced labor for the state. But they take the piles of human hair, and they nowadays and after the war and the propaganda say, no, this is evidence of gassing. And then people will say, no, I know what happened because I saw the hair. I saw the hair. And you can't argue with that because they
can you show me a body at any of the camps that was healthy and not emaciated and near the point of starvation? I mean, clearly people starved to death, which is the main method of death in every war since ancient times.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, exactly. And at the end of the war, when the Germans were marching a lot of these inmates west, everyone had a hand in that part of the horrible story, because on the one hand, the German state didn't want to leave these poor wretches behind. They wanted to try to conserve their labor force, so they force marched them west. But the Allies also, through the bombing campaigns, had eliminated the German rail system, so there wouldn't have been trains. And then most of the trucks were destroyed.
They couldn't import food either.
Yeah.
Little they had, which was part of a campaign to starve everyone anyway, that they were trying to starve the Germans. They tried to starve the Japanese, living on 1,000 calories a day, civilian and military alike, which also means the prisoners are going to starve.
Yeah, exactly. And so the people who were, the civilians who were interned, can only be seen as the victims of a conflict between several brutal states, and they were in the middle of it. And that's one of the things I used to make that point constantly, that it's never a matter of excusing what happened. But what will sometimes happen with a guy like me, and Grandmar Rudolph as well, I remember us talking about this a long time ago, you get very much into the specifics of the historiography, and I kind of liken it to a pathologist. If you're a coroner and that's your job, you can't allow yourself to get too emotional about the bodies you're cutting up, because you won't be able to do a good job if you let your human emotions take over and you start crying every time a little child is brought in front of you and you've got to find out how they died and cut the body open. There has to be, you sort of have to, and I hate this term, but you have to compartmentalize it. And when you're doing the work, you can't really let yourself get emotional about it. You just have to think about the answers you're trying to get. And then separately, of course, if you're a decent human being, you're able to understand, wow, this is a terrible thing that this kid just died. And I feel terrible about it, but you do have to make yourself a little bit immune from the emotions of it. And I mean, I did that when I, the four different times I toured all the camps, and did my work in, the four times in Eastern Europe and then two other times that were, in the West. So all of those times, I mean, yeah, you realize you're in a bad place. But you just have to stay focused on the answers that you're there to get and put aside the emotion for later.
You can't walk in with a conclusion in mind. You're supposed to look at the evidence and then come up with a conclusion, not have a conclusion and then go look for evidence of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And you've got to look at everything very analytically, And in a lot of cases, some of the places I went to and did research in were camps that no one else had ever studied, or specifically areas of camps that nobody else had ever studied. And I'm not trying to denigrate the work of the revisionists who came before me, Farzin being one, David Irving was never per se a Holocaust historian. David Irving's a World War II historian. His scope was always larger. For him, Auschwitz revisionism was something he got into in the late 80s and the early 90s.
Sure. He wrote a book about Dresden, and he's also written a lot about Hitler himself by his kind of point of view. And the man, he learned German, he worked there, but he's much more into World War II as a whole.
Yeah, he's what one would call a military historian, or even just a general World War II historian. But there were revisionists who had been doing work in those areas before me. But a lot of times it was very spotty work. And one of the things that I'm very grateful to Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review was that he took an interest in me early on, very early on, and began publishing some of my work. This is one of those things that will get me in trouble, I know, but I say it almost every time I speak somewhere these days. Mark Weber is a fine historian and probably is the person who taught me, more than anyone, the true art of the discipline of being a historian. That doesn't mean I agree with everything that the IHR publishes. They're a publishing company, and I don't agree with everything that my own publishing company publishes. But that's not the point. The world is not mine for me to say what's right and wrong.
I don't agree with everything my guests come on and say, but I agree with their right to say it, and I'll bring a counterpoint on afterward or whatever. But yeah, you gotta allow everyone to write what they want to write, say what they want to say, and it's up to them to defend it.
This is a point I've made over and over again about Ernst Zundel. I've known Ernst Zundel since 92. And there's a lot of stuff he says that I just flat out don't agree with. But I will never stop fighting for his right to be a free man. And even when I was, a lot of people don't know this, but this is another thing I go into more detail about in my book. But even when I was undercover, when I was David Stein, I'd thrown away the David Cole persona, I still did work to help Zundel's case in 2004 and 2005 and 2006, during the period when he was going to be transferred from his little tin can cell in Toronto to Germany to serve his longer sentence. I worked with his wife, and I did a lot of stuff for him, because that's, even if I had kissed Holocaust history goodbye, which I did for a while after I left, I didn't really stay up with the subject matter anymore. But the free speech aspect of it, nothing could get my goat more than what was happening to Zundel and Rudolf. So even in my David Stein persona, secretly, anonymously, working with Bradley Smith, who's been a friend of mine since 89, we did work for Zundel and Rudolf. In fact, I edited a film that was shown to great controversy at a film festival in Baja in 2007. And it was a film about the plight of Zundel and Rudolf. The film, my name's not on it, and is purposely not on it, because I did the editing anonymously.
Germany Off Your Knees or another film?
No, it's called, because it was shown in Baja, so we gave it a Spanish title. It's called El Gran Tabú, or The Great Taboo. And this is a funny thing, because I was mainstream at this point, because David Stein, Mr. Mainstream Guy, that thing was edited at the Fox TV studios, which I think is cool. It was edited in the middle of the night, when nobody except the editors are there. And so here you have a film about Ernst Zundel and Germán Rudolf being edited at one of the biggest networks in the world in the wee hours of the night. And so there was probably, because of the equipment I had access to, probably a couple, like $1 million worth of time and effort put into that for only a couple of thousand, because of my connections there. So
that's really ironic, because the film I edited is called, in English, More Than Taboo.
Oh, really? The Holocaust. What's, yes. Huh, that's interesting, yeah. What year did you do that one?
That was without me knowing anything about it. That was 2008, I think. I finished it in 2008. Yeah. But yeah, 7 or 8.
When Bradley Smith took El Gran Tabú to the festival in Baja, the audience didn't know what to expect. Now, this audience was primarily young Mexican kids, film buffs, film students, filmmakers. And there was an American co-sponsor for this film festival. It was sponsored in part by a Mexican organization and in part by an American educational organization in San Diego. When the American co-sponsor heard that Bradley Smith was going to be screening that film there, they pulled their support and plastered across their website, "We do not agree with the choices that the Baja International Film Festival has made in allowing Bradley Smith the Denier to show this denial film." Well, all that did was pack the room. All of these attendees at the festival wanted to see what the heck the fuss was about. And so we had, I wasn't there, of course, but Bradley.
Like when they burned Schur's book, Operation Darkheart.
Yeah.
The Pentagon bought up his book and they burned him. And of course, that made everybody think, well, if they don't want us to read it, now we have to go get the second edition, of course. And
exactly. Out. Yeah. These censorship attempts often, probably more often than not, backfire. And we had a great screening of this film. Bradley lost a lot of friends, though, because some of the people who had gotten him into the film festival, he had warned them. He said, "Look, do you really want me and my revisionist film in this festival? You're going to get flack." And they were like, "No, this is Mexico. No one cares about that stuff. We're fine. We're fine." But there was so much guff from the American side of the festival that the festival organizers got so pissed off that they lost their co-sponsor and they lost a couple of advertisers. So Bradley did lose a couple of friends from doing that. However, it's a very strong film, and it could certainly be updated now because Rudolph and Zundel's cases have come a long way since 2007.
It's just sad that people are thrown in jail for stating their opinion in evidence, and they're not trying to rally people up against Jews or saying, you know, the Aryan race, this and that, or anything fucking stupid. They're just saying, look, these are the numbers that we have, and here's our evidence. And if they're saying something dumb, like, you have the right to say Elvis is still alive if you want to, but people will very quickly debunk you, and you could say whatever you want about any other historical topic, and the normal process is just to disprove somebody when they say something that's obviously untrue. But not with the Holocaust. They want to get violent about it. And the last question I want to bring up, because we're going over time a little, is, you know, people will say, well, look, there are all these survivors who saw this happen. So it must have happened. I mean, are they lying, or is it selectively we're only hearing from, you know, certain people and the bulk of them don't have a voice? Or what's going on there? Because certainly people were at the camps who are alive today and they witnessed all of that. How can you argue with those people?
Well, there's two answers, and I'll try to make it brief. The first answer is, when it comes to survivor testimony, it's very important to go back and look at the earliest versions of it, because survivor testimony does tend to change with time. an example is, there's a fellow named Mel Mermelstein. Mel Mermelstein was an Auschwitz survivor who sued the Institute for Historical Review back in the 70s, and the suit went for a while. I mean, it was still going on by 1991. Different suit, different version of it. But he was in a constant lock legal battle with the IHR. And Mermelstein, very much like the, Mermelstein was a 1944 Jew, just like the one who came on the Montel show. And Mermelstein's testimony has changed. His earliest testimonies were that he didn't know what happened to his mother and, I believe his sister. And then eventually it just, as the decades go on, he now sees them gassed. It's not a matter so much of calling him a liar. It's more that, by the 1970s, survivors had become very aware of what was expected from them. And they, I hate to use a term like this, if probably someone's going to grab this audio and use it against me, but they needed a money shot. They needed a gas chamber story to make their story interesting. Otherwise, they'd either get ignored or they'd get pummeled. And I think the way that they could ethically rationalize it is that from their point of view, in order to keep their story and the story of their fellow survivors alive, they had to maybe repeat stuff they had only heard as rumor or repeat stuff that had been going around the camp at the time as rumor. But
plus there are so many survivors who didn't see anything like that. Who
came well, of course. Didn't, yeah.
But,
how
could that possibly happen? Somebody who was at the camp and suffered through all that and still came out and said, nope, there weren't any gas chambers or anything. I mean, they have no motivation to do that because you're not going to get paid to say something like that.
Exactly. There's no motivation. And I think, for example, of there was that terrible, I didn't like it, that girls liked it. There was this Roberto Benigni film called Life is Beautiful, where he plays an Italian Jew who gets sent to a camp. And for most Italian Jews, they were sent to a place called Fossoli, which was actually a pretty laid back camp in the spectrum of things. I'm not defending it. I'm just saying that if you rank the camps from harshest to the kind where the inmates could send mail, get packages, get visitors, Fossoli was like that. That was the experience of a great many of the Italian Jews. Mainly Italian Jews who were not Italian citizens, but just residents, a great number of Italian Jews who were Italian citizens never were interned anywhere. But the Fossoli camp, like I said, grading on a curve, was among the least harsh of the camps. And when Life is Beautiful came out, and in the movie, because it's not a historical film, it's a romantic comic tragedy. And in the film, Benigni's character gets away with a lot of stuff in the camp that he's sent to. He kind of gets to be mischievous and he gets away with some things. And the reviewers, a lot of the reviewers, including the LA Weekly, I remember the most strongly. And I believe that reviewer moved on to a much bigger paper, maybe the New York Times. But I remember the reviewer saying, this film is an outrage. It's a travesty. It shows a Jew being able to like move freely throughout a camp and cook a meal and hide his child and act silly.
Auschwitz had a theater and a pool.
Oh yeah, yeah, indeed. But the thing is,
that
survivors
just shocks people that no, there was no theater. There's no pool. It's still there.
It's still there, the theater is still there, it had its own money system. It had a whorehouse, it had a store where inmates could buy things. But the point I'm making is that these Italian Jews who don't have a gas chamber story to tell, no one wants to hear from them because their story doesn't have that money shot. And then there's the other point, which is that you could get, you know, legally, even if you're a survivor, if you say that you were at a camp and you didn't see the gas chambers, you can get prosecuted. I mean, especially if you're a non-Jewish survivor, because Auschwitz had quite a few Polish non-Jewish inmates and a lot of petty criminals as well in the main camp. So you're not just talking about being shunned, but you can actually get prosecuted if you say something about Auschwitz that diminishes the horror. So what has been forged over pretty much since the 70s is a culture where the survivors, they know what they're expected to say, and they say it, because otherwise they're not going to get heard. And as I said, ethically, I think the way that they rationalize it is, well, if this is the way that I can be heard and spread my story and let people know what I suffered through, okay, I'll embellish a little bit. And then you have the straight out frauds, of course, and you've had people who were not even ever in a camp who have written memoirs and books that have subsequently been shown to be complete fabrications.
Or an individual who was in 9 different camps and escaped from them all and kept getting recaptured.
Much embellishment on him, indeed. Yes, this is a certain individual who is, while being greatly respected by many in the international community, has embellished probably more than 100,000 high school students trying to write a good college entrance essay.
It has the danger of the baby in the bathwater too, because when you get schmucks like that who just have these ridiculous stories, then people start to discount crimes that really did happen, all the people who were shot and worked to death and beaten and all the horror that actually happened, but they start to think, well, this is all just hokum, because they've heard what that certain individual and others have said, that are, you know, anybody with a 6th grade education can just listen to that and say, I don't think so.
Oh, I agree. And the thing is, Ryan, and I don't know if a couple of your listeners might not like this, but I've been trying to be very, very straightforward with revisionists now that I'm back, saying, you can't dismiss everything. Jews were killed. There's indisputable evidence, especially during the first stage of the invasion of Russia by the Germans. That there's definite evidence. David Irving and Mark Weber and I are all pretty much on the same page in that. And Irving,
oh yeah, absolutely. Jews were killed because they were Jewish. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, and occasionally I'll meet someone who is thinking that I'm all about dismissing everything. And I say, no, that would be just as bad as accepting everything. Everything has to be looked at individually. One has to study the activities of the Einsatzkommando units during the invasion of Russia and the very indisputable evidence of what they were doing to Jews on the Russian front during that period of the war. And one has to look at everything and just not be dogmatic on either side. And I hope that when I'm dead and gone, hopefully later rather than sooner, but I'll hope that that's something people will say about me, is that Stein-Cole was not unduly dogmatic. I can be irritable, as you know, from Facebook. I can be very irritable these days, and I can be a little impatient, but I try not to be dogmatic. That's one of the things that's most important to me.
Yeah, and it does seem that people get in the camp of either accepting everything or rejecting everything and really not thinking about anything, and that's the sad thing. But just as a quick example of how controlled the information can be, press-wise and historically, talking about prisoners, for example, as we were, but eyewitnesses and such, if you look at Operation Keyhole, where 2 million prisoners were killed, this is after the war, they sent them back to Stalin. People from Ukraine or Russians who turned against them, against Stalin, which, why wouldn't you? And they knew that Stalin was going to put them to death, and he did. And this is a man who the Allied powers allied with even after he'd killed tens of millions of people in the Ukraine, prior to Hitler ever even coming on the scene, and they still allied with the Russians. But this is something that is missing from history books, and the British especially, but also the Americans, rounded up prisoners, tied them up, drugged them, and sent them back to Stalin to be killed. Millions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where is that story?
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
You can hide something that big. What else can you lie about? That's what you have to think about.
Yeah, and I think that there are so many interesting and necessary stories still to come out about that war, because even though it's been so many decades, there's been such a level of covering stuff up to the extent of imprisoning people simply for writing pamphlets or on the internet. I want to do with whatever I can, with whatever good my book can do, whatever good I can do. I want the stuff that has not been widely talked about to be talked about. That's my biggest goal right now.
Well, I'll have your book linked right below this talk, and I appreciate your time, and I'll have you back on because this is a topic that cannot be summed up in an hour, hour and a half. It's just impossible to get into all of it. But I hope people will read it, and I hope people will keep an open mind on both sides, the fanatics that are in denial of, you know, these Hitler worshippers and stuff, these weirdos, and then also the Zionist fanatical racist who need a new Hitler and try and say there's 20 million people killed and this and that and use it to justify killing Palestinians, Iraqis, or anyone else. I mean, you have to take an objective look at history and not demonize the speaker. And maybe David's wrong about something, but what, you know, if he says this about one camp or another, then just get the information and he'll go, okay, I'm wrong, whatever. It's not about who's right, it's about what's right. But we can never get at what's right if you're going to throw people in jail for even having questions.
Exactly. Exactly. Well said. And that's the most important point. And that's something I'll never stop fighting against.
All right, well, thank you for your time, and I hope I can have you in the future, and I hope this won't get me too ostracized for daring to tackle the subject.
Ryan, you've been a wonderful host, and I do look forward to coming back on the air with you, and so I do hope you don't get too much flack. I hope people, the very least, even if they don't like what I say, they can hear my voice and imagine I'm Jerry Lewis, because that's what everybody says I sound like. So maybe they can just get a laugh out of that. But you've been wonderful, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Thank you. That was author David Cull, or David Stein. This man had to go into hiding for years after he was physically assaulted and his life threatened by the various Jewish Defense Leagues and his livelihood attacked by the ADL and all these racist groups who just have a fit about anybody not towing the official line about World War II and the great rescue story of good guys versus evildoers.